drape the gate like braces around your jaded faces, you basehead casements. Fuck off. It's the Blind Boy Podcast, and you're very welcome. I am currently on a live podcast tour. So before we continue, just a couple of quick dates for April. Right, this Friday, the 5th, I am in Nace in the Moat Theatre interviewing Colm O'Gorman, who is the head of Amnesty International in Ireland, and he's a sound bastard. I spoke with Colm before backstage at Electric Picnic. Una Mullally came over to interview us very briefly together. We had a quick conversation for like 10 minutes. But we were absolutely, we really clicked. Do you know, we really clicked. And I could see by 10 minutes into it, Colm was getting emotional. Such was the clicking we did. And then it was all gone because I had to go on stage. So I'm looking forward to interviewing Colm O'Gorman. He's an interesting character. 6th and the 7th, Vicar Street in Dublin. As part of, I think it's Music Town it's called or something. So on both nights, I will be interviewing guests that are related to music. On Saturday, I've got a fucking lovely lineup, lads. I wanted to pick just some Irish musical acts who I personally enjoy at the moment, who I think are making good music. So I've got a little panel of artists who I'll be interviewing and having crack with. And it's going to be Quiva from Wyvern Lingo, Junior Brother, and Keane Kavanagh from Soft Boy Records, which is Keane and Kojak founded Soft Boy. They're a very exciting kind of label and movement in Ireland at the moment. Kojak was supposed to come on, but he's over in London getting his pubes pixelated in Dalston. Then Sunday the 7th of April 2019, I've got a very special surprise guest who I'm not going to fucking tell you about. So there's some tickets left for all of those nights, really. They're almost nearly sold out, but you can still get tickets. Then on the 12th, Whitla Hall, Belfast. Belfast? Yeah, fuck it, I'm going to call it Belfast now. Fuck Belfast. Belfast. Like Derry, Londonderry. So I'm in Belfast on the 12th of April, and I don't know who I'm interviewing there. And then I'm down in Cork in the Opera House on the 27th of April. Don't know who I'm interviewing there. Alright. So come along to them. It'll be good crack, please. Oh yes, and of course, the morning of the 6th of April, 2019, tickets for the live podcasts in Toronto and Vancouver go on sale. They're going to sell out, I would imagine, within an hour, because I don't think the venues are huge. I think there's only like 200, they're like 200 seater venues, so they're going to sell fast. So get online the morning of the 6th of April, probably Canadian time, whenever their morning is. Oh fuck, sure, Vancouver and Toronto, they're, Jesus Christ, that's too much for my head anyway. I don't know, keep an eye on the internet. I don't know, I don't even know what fucking venues I'm playing in, alright? Jesus, I'm shit at promoting gigs, alright. So, yeah, promoters, did you hear that? Did you hear that? That's the sound of me fulfilling my contractual obligations. Okay, I advertised the gig at the front of the podcast, you cunts. Moving on. So it's the 2nd of April. The clocks went forward there at the weekend, which was greatly confusing for me. I hate when fucking daylight savings happens, because I just can't make sense of it. I can't make sense of whether I lose sleep or gain it. Because, as I said last week, I'm just shit with numbers and time and readings and things like that. But yeah, so the evenings are longer. That, for me, officially means the end of winter, you know. So I got cocky this morning. I got cocky. And I wanted to go for a lovely, big, long run before I got writing. The deadline for my second book of short stories is looming, so I'm writing feverishly every day, several thousand words. But before I do that, I have to either go for a 10-kilometer run or go to the gym to lift weights, just because that type of shit, you start your day like that with all those endorphins releasing around your body, it gives you energy, it gives you physical and mental energy and a vibe of positivity. So that's the first thing I do in the morning, and then I sit down to write. So this morning, I open the door, and it's fucking gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. The sun is belting down. It's not warm. You know, it's cold, but you know when, do you know when it's cold, but the sun is out? So the promise of its rays on your back will actually keep you warm, even though it's, the temperature isn't that actually warm. So I said, fuck it, man. I'm going out, t-shirt and shorts, and I'm going for a big long run down by the river. So I did. And then I'm about 20 minutes into it with this lovely, lovely sun. And out of fucking nowhere, right? I'm talking within the space of a minute of a and a half, the sky turns black. And there's this roaring gale. And it starts snowing. Or sleet. Do you know what? I think it was sleet. Sleet is like a strange little snow, hailstone, rain, hybrid that cuts your face like razor blades. So I was there in my fucking t-shirt about 5k into the run. No point going back, so you just run through it, you know. Getting battered with this wet sleet. Now I fucking hate that, because what can happen is if you run a 10k and you've a t-shirt that's wet, it hardens your nipples and you can end up with bleeding nipples, which is a very unpleasant side effect of running for long distances. So I'm getting battered to fuck by this unpleasant sideways rain, which lasts about 10 minutes. And then it's sunny again. Then it's so fucking sunny and calm that the sun dries my soaking t-shirt. Then I get in home, have a shower, come out of the shower, look out the window, and even stronger gale with heavy, heavy rain this time. And I just couldn't believe it. I was like, this is, what type of madness is going on with this weather? Why, how can the weather switch from such dichotomous extremes in such a short amount of time? And then I remembered, it's the first 3 days of April. And my ma always told me that any time it was shitty in the first 3 days of April with the weather, my ma would tell me this story. It's an old Irish legend, like years and years old, an old mythology, and it's called An Bo Réabhach, which is Irish for the brindle cow. And brindle is brindle's a fur pattern. Brindle is like it's like a chestnut brown that has black patches on it, or streaky patches. You'd see the odd, if you see a pit bull terrier, brown pit bull terriers that are kind of chestnut and have kind of black stripes, that's a brindle pattern and a brindle colour. So this old Irish legend called the Brindle Cow on Bo Réabhach, which addresses the insanity of the first 3 days of April. And it's a beautiful story. Why it's encapsulates perfectly the fantastic humour and surreal irrationality of the Irish psyche, you know, which I think has to be influenced by the weather. I mean, Irish culture and, you know, how we speak and our literature, you know, from Flann O'Brien right back to the Táin or even James Joyce, there's a real playful, humorous irrationality and surreality to our kind of culture. And anyway, this story, it's about this brindled brown patterned cow who is, they have a, the weather in March is kind of, because March is shitty, you know, so the cow is like, the weather in March is shit and raining and cold all the time, and the cow's out in the field putting up with it, you know, going, fuck this March weather anyway, you know, it's grand, I'll deal with it. And then March ends, and as soon as March ends, the cow, she gets cocky about March. She goes, fuck March with its shit weather. I put up with 28 fucking days of that shit month with its cold wind and it's wet. Well, fuck March. March can go fuck itself. But the cow's all cocky, you know. She's all cocky about March because she has the safety of April and she has the confidence and knowledge that April will be mild. So she's no hassle bad-mouthing March. So then March, the month, the unit of time, gets pissed off with the talking cow. And March says, well, fuck that cow. Who the fuck is that cow to be talking shit about me from April? You think you're hard, do you? Over in April, talking shit about me. Well, fuck you. So March decides that it's going to jump ahead in time. And March asks April, can it borrow a couple of days? So then April says to March, come on, so March, I'll give you you can have the first 3 days of my month for the crack. Because to be honest with you, I don't like the way that cow is talking shit either. I think that cow is being cocky and they're hiding behind me. That cow is hiding behind me, April. So do you know what, March? I'm going to give you the first 3 days and you can get a bit of revenge. So March gets revenge on the cow by borrowing the first 3 days of April. So what ensues from April 1st is this incredibly erratic, violent weather of, in particular, very, very strong, cold, wet winds. And on the first day of April, the winds knock the cow over. And she's like begging for mercy, going, oh, alright, March, I'm sorry, chill out. March is like, fuck you, bitch, not a hope. Then the second day of April, March is going nuts, and March is like, I'm going to kill you. So the cow dies on the second day of April. And then on the third day of April, the wind of March is so extreme and cold that it strips the flesh off the cow. All her fur, her brindle fur and her flesh flies into the fucking universe and it bleaches her bones. And then after the third day of April, March is like, grand, alright, I'll talk to you next year, April. Thanks for that. And then April continues on, all calm, as the dead cow bleaches in a field. And isn't that just fucking beautiful? Isn't that just gorgeous? And it's like, it's mad, because I think back, my ma used to say that to me all the time, the first 3 days of April are shit. And it's true. And it's obviously some weird fucking pattern that's been going on for ages in the weather. And some person 1,000 years ago with way too much time on their hands is just like, yeah, that's why it happens. It's a conversation between 2 months because they're pissed off with a cocky cow. And I was that cow today. When I went out for that run, I opened up the door and I said, it's sunny, and decided I'm going to go in shorts and a fucking t-shirt, and then arrived home with my fucking nipples nearly bleeding. I was that cow. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. To be a part of that cosmic act of theatre, I suppose you'd call it, you know, it made me smile. But I do have sore nipples, so fuck it. I despise my nipples. I have unnecessarily large brown areolas, and I wouldn't mind them getting bleached by the first 3 days of April, to tell you the truth. Very foolish looking chest I have. Write that on my gravestone. I don't really have any specific hot takes this week, I don't think. Last week was boiling hot. Last week's podcast was about the impact of the music of the Beach Boys on Nirvana. And I fucking love doing it. I loved it. It was a very intense experience. I love doing podcasts where I can speak in a very concentrated, passionate way about something I really care about. But yeah, the thing with hot takes take a lot of energy. So I can't rely upon a Biden hot take every week, or else I'd be spoofing. So this week's one, I think I'm going to ramble and see what it takes me, do you know? Might do a bit of, do you know what I haven't done in fucking ages as well? I do it in a while, and there's been a lot of people asking for it. I haven't read out Donald Trump's tweets as my drunk Limerick aunt in a long time. I haven't done that in maybe, I'd say 15 podcasts possibly. So we'll do a small bit of that. But speaking of politicians' tweets, Brexit is going on at the moment, you know, which is, I don't know what's fucking happening with Brexit. Listen, I'm looking at the news every hour and I can't tell what's happening with Brexit. It's insanity. So I'm just kind of chilling out. I'm just kind of backing off from it. But one thing that I don't know, struck me today as interesting was Emmanuel Macron, who is either president or prime minister of France. President, I think. So Emmanuel Macron, within the flurry of this Brexit madness, publicly declares, right, a very definite and strong statement for a politician to make. And the thing is, politicians generally don't make really strong statements, and when they do, it's hard to take it at face value. It's like there has to be an ulterior motive. So Macron says, France will never let Ireland down. Okay? In reference to, you know, the bullshit that Brexit means for Ireland. Brexit essentially violates the Good Friday Agreement. We're very concerned here about the return of a hard border in the north of Ireland. Very concerned about it, because nobody wants that. What people want is fucking a united Ireland, to be honest. That's the word on the street. That's what most people that I know want, a fucking united Ireland, and for the Brits to just get the fuck out completely of the country. But a hard border is something nobody wants, because just fuck that. I don't even have to explain why. I remember very young, like I was about fucking 9, but I do remember going up to the north when I was about 9 and being in the back of the car and just seeing a British soldier just pointing a gun in my dad's face. Not necessarily aggressively, not like I'm going to shoot you, but just, and I suppose it's pure southern privilege on my part, because, you know, for people living up north, that was their fucking lives. But for me as a tourist going up north as a kid, it's like you've got this life down in Limerick where there's no soldiers, and then you go to the north of Ireland and you go to this checkpoint, and all of a sudden there's this young soldier with a huge machine gun, and he's talking to my dad and he's pointing the gun at my dad's face. It wasn't resting by his side, it's like holding it and I'm pointing this at your face, sir, a fucking machine gun. Not necessarily as an act of aggression, but just that's how it was. If you move one inch, I'm legally allowed to murder you and your family. That's what I'll do if I think that you're going to drive ahead. So that was fucking awful. And it stuck with me as a kid as being very traumatising and frightening, and something I never ever wanted to see. For the people of Belfast and the people of Derry, that was their fucking daily lives. Okay? So no one wants a return to that. No one wants the RA back. No one wants the fucking UVF. No one wants conflict. So Macron says, France will never let Ireland down. So basically, on the surface, what he's saying is, whatever bullshit England are going to pull with this Brexit stuff, the EU will 100% back Ireland and favour Ireland, as because Ireland is a member state. That's what he's saying on the surface. What I didn't like about the comment, right, it's obviously well-intentioned on the surface. What I didn't like about it is that I don't believe Macron when he says France will never let Ireland down. I don't believe he's making that statement for a love of Ireland, for a solidarity with Ireland. I think he's playing colonial tennis, which is this weird thing that former colonial powers do. When Macron says France will never let Ireland down, all he's doing is taking a dig at England. He's jabbing England or Britain. And it's this weird thing. When I speak to my British pals about, you know, what the fuck did you actually learn in school? I say to them, did you learn about the horrors and murder that went on with British colonialism? Did you learn about that? And most of my British pals say, not really, no. We didn't. We learned a little bit about colonialism, but in general, the gist of what we learned was how the Spanish were really bad and how the French were terrible at colonialism and they were really nasty. And the British are good because the British ended slavery, even though they invented it. The modern, you know, well, I won't say the British invented it, but the Portuguese were probably the first to do the African slave trade, but the Brits really fucking, they really turned it into an industry. But that's what my British mates say. We learned about how the French were bad and how the Spanish were bad and how Britain ended slavery and Britain's colonialism was good, which it wasn't, fuck that. So that's what Macron is doing. He's taking potshots at Britain. It's an old colonial game. Do you know? And the reason I think that is just, like, Macron he's defended the French colonialism in Africa. What's going on in the country at the moment with the Yellow Jacket protests and police brutality? He's a centrist right winger. Do you know? So I don't believe him. I don't believe it's like all of a sudden he's got love and compassion for Ireland. It's a desire to take a jab at England, to old colonial enemy, playing out those old politics with us being used as a tennis ball, essentially. And, of course, then a desire to, I mean, from the EU's perspective, they have to make sure that when Britain leaves, that no other country looks at Britain and goes, fuck it, they got a pretty good deal. So it's in the interest of the EU to be harsh on Britain so that no one else thinks of leaving. But yeah, the colonial tennis match that I'm talking about there with Ireland as the ball, this bizarre competition that former empires engage in with each other, it reminded me of Roger Casement. And Casement, I think he was given a knighthood for it. I think that's why he got a knighthood. But Roger Casement was an Irish revolutionary. He tried to smuggle guns in for the 1916 Rising and he was executed. A proud Irish revolutionary. But Casement also worked for the Brits. He was a British diplomat. He was knighted. He's considered the father of human rights, you know. But what Casement basically did, his big thing that he did for the Brits, is the Belgians, who, you know, a very small nation, but also a colonial power, the Belgians were, with King Leopold specifically, the King of Belgium, had kind of declared the Congo. The Congo in Africa was called Leopoldville, and it was like his own little personal state. It's like it wasn't even, yes, it was colonized by Belgium, but it was like an area that actually belonged to Leopold himself, like his own little personal experiment. And King Leopold was committing unbelievable atrocities and slavery in the Congo. Mass murder, chopping fucking limbs off, enforced slavery, disgusting shit. So Casement came out with this thing called the Casement Report, I believe, which basically detailed the huge amounts of crimes and inhumanity that was being committed in the Congo at the hands of Leopold and Belgium. And the British powers celebrated this massively. They celebrated Casement as a hero for, you know, in uncovering this. But, you know, like, do you think the British Empire all of a sudden gave a shit about fucking Africans in the Congo? You know, considering what they would have been doing in Nigeria at the time, or what they were doing in India, or what they were doing in Ireland. So why all of a sudden does the British Empire give a shit about fucking human rights? And it's like, they don't. First off, they were bolstering this, oh, we're the British, we stopped slavery business, so now we're going to stop it in the Congo. Mostly what they were doing was just taking a jab at Belgium. it was just a way to hold up another colonial power and go, ha ha ha, look what they're doing. Look how bad they are at colonialism. They're so mean and nasty. Without taking into account what Britain's actually doing at the exact same time in their own colonies. And that's a little bit, I might be reading too much into it. My take might be too hot. But I got a bang of that off Macron's comment when he said France will stand by Ireland at all costs. What did he say? No, France will never let Ireland down. Fuck off, spoofer. As if the French give a fuck about the Irish. And I had one experience. I'm basing this on one experience that I had in France. I was in a restaurant. One of my friends got married in France about fucking a couple of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. So I went over to France. And France is weird. It's the only tourist place where you'll go to where, like, if you speak English, they're not having it. They fucking won't have it. You go to your fucking hotel in France, and if you're speaking English, they will make you speak a little bit of French just for the effort of it. They fucking hate it. Other countries, Spain don't really mind people speaking English. I know the Dutch don't. Barcelona. In my experience, the best place to get away with speaking English is fucking Barcelona, because they identify as Catalan, so they don't particularly like speaking Spanish that much as well, so English is a nice compromise. I don't have any fucking European languages, so I hate it. I hate going to countries and speaking English, mainly because I don't want them thinking that I'm a Brit or a Yank. So usually what I'll do is I'll speak a small bit of Irish, and then if I speak a small bit of Irish and the person doesn't understand me, then they will suggest English as a compromise, because English is the language of tourism. So sometimes I'll do that so that they don't think I'm a Brit or a Yank. But I was in a restaurant anyway, and I was confronted with just a shocking amount of rudeness. So what the restaurant, this is how class France is. I was staying in, like, just a regular fucking hotel, and the restaurant that was in the hotel happened to just be a Michelin-starred restaurant. Wasn't even expensive, to be honest. It was just, here's our hotel. By the way, the restaurant has a fucking Michelin star. So I went in there and I sat down and ordered whatever fucking course was there. Of course, the menu's in French. So I just ordered whatever's there. And they come down to me with a starter. Fucking bone marrow. Now, I'd never seen bone marrow in my life. I didn't know people eat the inside of bones. Hadn't a clue. So they threw this fucking bone down in the middle of the table with this weird skinny toast and knives and forks. So I'm sitting, and then this shot glass of, like, a meaty gazpacho, like a meaty cold tomato soup. I don't know what the fuck it was. So I'm sitting down there like a langer, with my bone in front of me, and I don't know what to do with it. I haven't a fucking clue what to do with it. So the waiter comes over, and he speaks a bit of English. He says, is there a problem? And I said, look, what is this? And he starts chuckling, and he goes, oh, it's bone marrow. And then I say, what do I do with it? How do I eat it? So he shows me, he fucking gets the butter knife, sticks it into the bone, puts it onto the toast, and says, there, eat that. Which I'd never seen. How the fuck am I supposed to know about bone marrow? From Ireland, we don't eat the inside of bones. And then, after I did it, he turned around to all the other customers and said really, really loudly, Irlande, which means Irish person. And then he laughed, and everyone else laughed. And it made me feel like one of those shitty caricatures, those racist caricatures of Irish people that the Brits and the Yanks used to print, you know? An ape-like creature sitting on a lot of dynamite. It made me feel like that. And it was shit. It was shit. So that made me think, right, well, that's sheer and utter fucking French colonialism. No different to the type of thing you might get from a posh Brit. An air of superiority and all of this, because the Irish are animals. And then as I got kind of looking into it more, I heard about this thing. I think it's called Paris syndrome. And it's fucking fascinating. It's like a site-specific form of, I don't want to go so far and say psychosis, but it's like a site-specific mental health issue or mental illness issue that happens almost exclusively to Asian people who visit Paris. Most specifically Japanese, but also Chinese and Korean. And like Paris is kind of fetishized a bit in Asia. Like in China, like one of the things in China at the moment is a huge portion of the Chinese economy for the past 20 years, I believe, is based on this giant fucking property bubble. I'm pulling this figure out of my arse. It's 90% accurate, right? But I think I heard that, like, in the past 50 years, even less maybe, I think it might be even 30, 20 years, China has used more concrete than the entirety of the West since the start of the Industrial Revolution. So, in China, there's entire cities that are built and no one lives in there. They're being built for the sake of building to prop up a bubble. But there is this area of China and it's creepy. It's this city or this town called Tianducheng, right? So basically the Chinese built this entire city that is literally a replica of parts of Paris, and then I think another section is like parts of London. Like a perfect, like a city you can live in, proper houses, and it looks exactly like Paris and London to a T. They've rebuilt it. They have a fucking Eiffel Tower. They have a replica of the Eiffel Tower. And again, because there's this mad property bubble, China have built too much shit. So it was built as something that they'd hoped incredibly wealthy Chinese people would go and live in this fake Paris in China. But that's not the case. Because there's too much property, the people that are living there are kind of poor to middle income people. So it's not really luxury Paris. It's like people hanging their jocks out the window in these amazing French colonial buildings. But this is, you know, it's symptomatic of the Asian fetishization of tourism to places like Paris and London. So anyway, Paris syndrome is this really rare psychological condition. It happens to about 50 people a year from mostly Japan when they visit Paris. And it's the symptoms of it are like extremely high stress, but also temporary psychosis, like hallucinations, and like depersonalization and derealization. Like those are things that go hand in hand with, to me it sounds like, you know, a couple of podcasts back I did the podcast on what it's like to live with severe anxiety and to repeatedly get panic attacks, and you depersonalize and are under intense stress all the time. It sounds like that. But anyway, Japanese people visit fucking Paris and end up in this situation. Not all like I said, 50 people a year is fuck all considering the amount of tourism, but it's enough to merit a what the fuck. So there's many theories behind it. We spoke in about 25 podcasts ago, longer, more even, I'd say, Jesus. I did an episode on collectivism within Asian societies and specifically rice growing cultures. Japan is a society whereby it is founded upon collectivism. And with collectivism, people cooperate with each other and they're polite to each other. And they all kind of move forward not in a selfish way, not in an individualistic way, but in a collective way, they all cooperate and tolerate each other for a greater good of the community. And in the podcast I discussed, this exists most likely because cultures that have rice as the staple food, they were founded upon a culture whereby if you need to grow rice for a village, everyone has to get stuck in. Simple as that. Rice is a difficult thing that requires everyone to get involved in. So if everyone doesn't pull their weight with rice, you starve. So this results in Japanese collectivism, okay? So France is an incredibly individualistic culture. It's Western as fuck. It's about me, me, me. You know, the concept of France came up with, like, no, they didn't come up with republicanism. It's an old Roman idea, I believe. But the French Republic is full personal liberation, personal freedom, individualism. Yes, you're part of a country, but you have the right to individual self-determination. That's the French way. So when these Japanese people visit France, firstly as well, a part of it is the fetishization of Paris. It's the belief that Paris is an incredibly magical, wonderful place where the best fashion comes from and the best culture comes from. So the Japanese people, they go to Paris with an incredibly high, unrealistic expectation of what it's going to be like. Then when they get there, the people are incredibly rude. Okay, I don't think it's xenophobic for me to say that Parisian culture is fucking rude. If you've been to Paris, you know the shtick. It's people are kind of rude there. You know, maybe they're not fucking rude. Maybe that's just how they are in comparison to, we'll say, Irish culture, where we can be rude, but we're also kind of, we can be nice as well. But in Paris, for as an Irish person, you go to Paris and it's like, Jesus, you're mean. So for a Japanese person, multiply that by 1,000. In Japan, where people don't even eat in public because that's considered rude, or you bump into someone, you apologize, all this type of stuff. That's how Japan is. So Japanese people go to Japan and a very small amount experience Paris syndrome, which is an intense, stressful sense of fucking shock at how dirty the place is. Or I think handbag snatchers were given as one example. When you go into a shop, like in Japan, customer service is very efficient and effective. When the customer walks in, they're given a lot of attention. But when you go in France, they don't give a fuck about you. These are things that I read now on a study that was done about it. But it's just crazy. It's fucking mad. The other kind of site-specific psychosis that springs to mind when I was thinking about Paris syndrome, there's Jerusalem syndrome. That's the other one. Which is, it's not as much crack as Paris syndrome, because Paris syndrome is kind of just, not to be a prick, but there's something kind of funny about Paris syndrome. Obviously, it's not funny for the poor person experiencing it. I'm sure it's incredibly painful, but as an elevator pitch, the idea of Japanese people going temporarily mad because they're so rude in France, you know, that's humorous. It sounds like a joke, even though I know for the people involved, of course, that's not humorous at all. That's going to be very stressful. But there's Jerusalem syndrome. And Jerusalem syndrome, that's kind of more widespread. It's widespread enough that in Jerusalem, there's a specific psychiatric hospital dedicated to treating that alone, because it's so common. And it's something that's been happening for fucking years, mostly amongst Christians. Jerusalem, obviously, you know, is it the birthplace of Christ? He born in Palestine? I don't know, I'm not that up on my Christianity, but Christ did a lot of shit in Jerusalem. He was knocking around Jerusalem, doing his thing. So it's a very important place to Christians. So this thing can happen, 50 people a year, where the Christian person will arrive in Jerusalem, and initially, you know, they'll feel depersonalized, they're not real, and they'll blame it on jet lag, they'll just think they're tired. And then all of a sudden, the person starts to exhibit very odd, irrational, messianic behavior. They will start to truly believe and think that they are, if not Christ, another major figure from the Bible. Now, they're not having crack, they're not playing. It's a kind of a stressful mania where they truly lose their sense of identity and believe themselves to be a biblical figure when they get to Jerusalem. The symptoms of it are, first, overwhelming fucking anxiety, because let's face it, depersonalization is no crack. Not being able to identify who you are is no crack. Followed by a sudden urge to, if you're with a group of people, to fuck off on your own. To no longer want to be with the people that you travel to Jerusalem with, to go off on your own. Then what usually follows is an obsession with cleanliness, persistent bathing, grooming, showering. Bizarrely, one that's like really common, taking all your clothes off and wearing a bed sheet. So wrapping yourself in a white bed sheet and wearing that. Roaring and shouting Bible verses. Going to a holy place with a sense of impassioned intent. And then finally, I shouldn't be laughing because I'm sure it's very distressful for the people that it's happening to, but delivering a sermon in the holy place that you go to and urging people to repent or whatever the fuck. And that's Jerusalem syndrome. Jerusalem syndrome. And I know it raises a chuckle, let's be fucking honest, you know, even though it shouldn't. But like tour guides in Jerusalem are trained to spot when this is going to happen. If they're bringing Christians around the gaff, the tour guides are trained to spot when someone is exhibiting Jerusalem syndrome. And it's a real thing that fucking happens, 50 people a year. And there's a psychiatric word for it. The general kind of consensus in psychology about, you know, what the fuck is the crack with Jerusalem syndrome, you know, can Jerusalem turn a person psychotic? Because, well, you know, what those symptoms are really, they're the symptoms of psychosis. And the consensus tends to be it's the people who experience Jerusalem syndrome already have a pre-existing underlying psychotic disorder or possibly a form of schizophrenia. And it can be the schizophrenia in the first place that kind of urges the person to get to Jerusalem in the first place, if you get me. So it's a pre-existing condition which manifests itself as a religious desire to go to Jerusalem, and then the symptoms fully present when the person reaches the apex of that journey. You know, that's the most modern reading of what it actually is. But it's been happening a long, long time. Those are the only two I can think of. I don't know how the fuck I got onto that. Glasgow syndrome. Glasgow syndrome is different. It's not a site-specific psychological disorder. It's an economic condition. It's, I think what it is off the top of my head, people in Glasgow tend to die young. There's a lot of early deaths in Glasgow, and it doesn't quite match other modern industrialized cities. That Glasgow has a unique type of syndrome and condition where people just die earlier, and it baffles people. They don't really know why. People dying from alcoholism, heart disease, suicide, things like that. There's a definite correlation with some type of social deprivation, but at the same time, they found that Glasgow isn't really, like, it's not necessarily any worse off than, like, Manchester or Sheffield or somewhere. So they can't really wrap their heads around it. But people die earlier in Glasgow. But 40 minutes in now, so it's probably time for an old ocarina pause or something. And then after the ocarina pause, I'll read out a few of Trump's tweets as your drunk Limerick aunt. Where the fuck is the ocarina? Right, the ocarina does not appear to be at hand. The banjo's at the other side of the room.
Where is it?
Yeah, that's at the back of the studio. And you know what? I've got a nice bit of fucking flow. I'm liking the ramble this week. Uninterrupted rambling, letting my head take me where I want it. Partly inspired, to be honest. I went back listening to Bill Burr. I enjoy Bill Burr's podcast, but I hadn't listened to him in a couple of months. And I listened to Bill Burr. And Bill Burr's podcast was one of the inspirations for me doing this. When I heard Bill Burr just simply, he just turns on the mic and he talks. And I used to love it. I used to love the freedom of it. And that inspired me. I said to myself, right, well, if Bill Burr can sit down once a week and press record and talk, then I can at least try. So I went back listening to Bill Burr, and it reminded me of, yeah, fuck it. What's wrong with just having a podcast with a long stream of conscious ramble? I hadn't done one in a while. So I don't have the fucking ocarina. What have we got? We had a lighter before. And we have a weed grinder. So we're going to have, a weed grinder pause this week for the adverts to go in. Let's see if this even makes noise. It's a plastic, one of those shitty plastic weed grinders. Okay, here's the weed grinder pause.
Ooh.
That's not particularly pleasurable, but I'm impressed by the acoustics of it. This is where you need one of those binaural mics now, or the stereo ones.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's the weed grinder pause, lads. That was, so if there was any digital adverts inserted... This podcast is sponsored by you, the listener, all right, via the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. If you like the podcast, if you're coming to it every week and you enjoy it, if you're the type of person who, I don't know, if I'm providing the podcast hug, as I describe it, which is the gentle, relaxing vibe and that little break in the day that you get out of listening to a podcast, if I'm providing that for you and you're thinking, fuck it, if I met Blind Boy in real life, I would buy him a cup of coffee or a pint. If you're of that mindset, you can do that via the Patreon page. Become a patron of the podcast, please do. Makes a huge difference to my life. The Patreon is the reason that I'm back here every single fucking week doing this podcast. If it wasn't for the Patreon, to be honest, I wouldn't be doing this every week. because I'm too fucking busy. Right now, I'm in the middle of writing my book. I'm trying to do several thousand words a day. I'm incredibly busy. And if I had the choice, I just wouldn't. I'd be taking a break from the podcast for a couple of months to focus 100% on the book. But because I have patrons who are giving me the price of a pint once a month, I have an obligation and a responsibility to just, I deliver every week. Simple as that. So please consider it. Patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. I fucking love it when people subscribe to the Patreon. But if you can't afford it, no hassle. That's no problem. You get the exact same podcast as everyone else. This is a donation model based on soundness. Some people can afford to be patrons. Some people can't. It's grand. We'll all be grand. Another nice thing you can do, if you're listening on iTunes, make sure and subscribe to the podcast. Make sure and leave a rating. Make sure and leave a review. That's a great thing that you can do. This podcast is now available on Spotify. If you're on Spotify, follow the podcast. And tweet about it. Suggest it to a friend, especially if you're not living in Ireland. This podcast is growing pretty fucking exponentially, internationally, in really mad countries that I didn't think it was going to grow in. And this is because of word of mouth. I'm going to Canada doing a lot of gigs because my Canadian listeners are telling their friends about it. And if they're in an office, they're telling their friends, I'm listening to this podcast. And that's turning into gigs. So please do that if it's not too much hassle. Tweet it, fucking Facebook, whatever the fuck. God bless. All right. It's time for the return of Donald Trump. Donald Trump's tweets being read by your drunk Limerick aunt. Let's go for it. Let's see what the prick is tweeting. So I'll set the scene. It's about 2 a.m. You're sitting down at home. You decide you want to rewatch The Sopranos. So you flick on the fucking Sopranos. You start at episode 1. You're about 3 episodes in. You're fucking loving it. You're relaxed. You're like, fuck me, I forgot how good The Sopranos were. The lights off. Just that blue glow of the television. And then you hear the keys in the hall door. And they're taking a little bit longer than usual. There's a rattle to them. And the hall door opens with a briskness and a slight slam. You know, something unbecoming for 2 a.m. It's your drunk Limerick aunt. And she's been drinking rosé. Sparkling rosé and Buckfast. That's what some of the girls in Limerick are drinking at the moment. Sparkling rosé and Buckfast. I've heard it's nice. I'm going to have to try it. So she's had a feed of sparkling rosé and Buckfast at her friend Sharon's house. And now she's back. She said a few words to the taxi driver. Now she's in the sitting room.
What are you watching? Is that Tony Soprano? I don't like him. I don't like his jowls. Don't like him at all. I think he's a prick. The way he shouts at Carmela. Why does she put up with him at all? Why does Carmela... Tony, she just roars at him all the time. Fucking leave him, girl, will you?
I haven't seen any Democrats down here at the border working with us, asking us to speak to any of us. They've an open invitation. We're getting overrun. Our facilities are over capacity. We're at emergency crisis.
After many, many years, decades, Mexico is apprehending large numbers of people at the southern border, mostly from Guatemala, Honduras and El Salvador. They've all been taking US money for years. And doing absolutely nothing for us, just like the Democrats in Congress. There's no amount of testimony or document production that can satisfy Jerry Nadler or Shifty Adam Schiff. It is now time to focus exclusively on properly running our great country. I'm going to bed.
So that was the welcome return of your drunk Limerick aunt
reading out Donald Trump's tweets. There you go. So, I want to do something new this week, something I've never done before. Just for the crack. So this week, I meditated for the first time in months, okay? I don't know why I stopped meditating. I think it's because just running and stuff like that, I didn't really need it. But this week, I just felt like I'm overwhelmed with work, to be honest. I've got a book deadline coming up. I have to have my book written by the end of May. I'm writing several thousand words a day. You know, having to delve into the state of flow in order to do that, which requires me to be quite grounded and relaxed. If I'm to write and actually be creative, I have to be quite grounded and relaxed and be able to have fun. But I'm also incredibly busy. Like, you know, this weekend of three fucking gigs, you know, that's tough going. A lot of preparation goes into that. I've got the podcast. I've my BBC series that's currently being edited. I often have to do voiceover work or little bits of editing in my studio for that. So I've no fucking time. From the moment I wake up in the morning to when I go to sleep at night, I am working. I love it. It's work that I fucking love doing. I'm passionate about it. It's fun. But when you're that busy, it can be very easy to, you don't notice if you're stressed at all, to be honest. You don't, not only do you not notice if you're stressed, I could have an injury. I could have like a sore foot, or I'd itchy palms, and you don't notice it because you're so busy and so absorbed. So I just got this, came into my head this week, I should meditate and be a bit more mindful so that I look after myself and that I don't, what I'm trying to avoid is burnout. When you're working really hard, especially when it's something you love doing, when I'm working on something I love doing, it doesn't feel like work, so I can very intensely do it from when I wake up until I go to bed. I've mentioned before, if I didn't have to sleep, I wouldn't. I get pissed off when I go to bed because it's like, here's 8 hours where I can't do that thing I want to do. So I just decided I'd fucking meditate. A very simple mindfulness meditation where I check in with my physical body and my emotions for 10 minutes, and I did it. And it was fucking phenomenal. It was amazing. I needed it so badly and I didn't know. I uncovered feelings of frustration, feelings of anger that I was having. And I uncovered a tension in my jaw that I wasn't aware of, a tension in my fists, the presence of underlying anger is what I uncovered from my meditation this week. I brought it into my awareness. Within all my business, I'm going around the place clenching my teeth and clenching my fists because something is making me feel angry. Probably, I'm probably angry at not being able to dedicate as much time to my book as I'd like. In a perfect world, I would just be writing my book. That's all I'd be doing. But the nature of the industry that I'm in, where I'm essentially self-employed, I'm a creative, I'm an artist, I know I have to strike while the fucking iron is hot. So if there's gigs going, I gotta take the gigs. I can't be turning down gigs. You have to take every bit of work that comes to you and work feverishly at it, because in 6 months' time, that can disappear really quickly. That's the nature of the fucking industry. Twitter could switch, it could flick a switch and all of a sudden all my followers on Twitter are worth nothing and I can't put the podcast out there, I can't promote. Shit can happen overnight with my job. So I gotta work feverishly and intensely and make sure that I'm doing it when the sun is shining. So I had a lot of anger around that because there's a frustration to it and an unfairness. I don't want to say unfairness. I experience it as an unfairness. It's not an unfairness. There's nothing unfair about there being work to be done that I can earn a living from. There's nothing unfair about that. But I'll take ownership of the fact that I experience it as an unfairness, because I prefer to just be writing my book. So that all came up for me during meditation, and I'm so grateful and glad that it did. And not only that, the 10 minutes of meditation gave me a catharsis and a relaxation and a letting go of bodily and mental tension that I didn't know that I was carrying, and it all left, and I felt fucking amazing. I felt more rested from 10 minutes of meditation than from any of the sleeps I've been getting recently. Meditation is one of the most powerful tools that is available to the human body. It's kind of like, it's not far off wanking. It's in that territory. It's like, oh my God, what? It's free? Here's a free thing that I can do, and it releases all these chemicals in my brain, and I don't need special equipment. Well, some people do, but like, I don't need special equipment, and I can just do this. Meditation is like that. When you meditate and you can do it, you're left afterwards going, I can't believe this is free. I can't believe I can take 10 minutes out of my day and feel like I've just taken this incredible drug. And it's like, you haven't. You've released natural endorphins and chemicals throughout your body, and it's a thing that we can switch on. And it's not spiritual, it's not religious, it's not supernatural. It's a very simple exercise in awareness and mindfulness. So, and it's something that I used to do it daily, and then, like I said, I kind of stopped. And that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. Some people do it a lot. Some people do it twice a day, three times a day. I do it when I need it. It can be a very useful and helpful tool for your mental health processes. It can be great to understand your emotions, to truly know what you're feeling, to be able to name it, and to be able to take ownership of it. When negative emotions like tension, anger, anxiety exist as a hum that kind of controls us outside of our conscious awareness, you can carry anger around and anxiety around for weeks and not really know. You know, it's like, you know, but you can't name it. You just don't feel right. You don't know why. You just don't feel right, because too much energy is in the head. Continual thinking all day long. Thinking, thinking, thinking. And you're spending no time then in the body. What meditation does is it allows us to spend a little bit of time in the body. Out of the head. Out of the continual non-stop thoughts of how busy you are, or the tasks you need to do, or who you're pissed off with. All that intense head thinking that keeps us out of our body, that keeps us not aware of a sore foot or a pain in our tummy. Do you know? Meditation allows that to happen. So what I'm going to fucking chance this week for the crack, because why not? I might do a little, and I've never done this before, a short 10 minute guided meditation that, if you want, I'll do it at the end of the podcast. You can do this. You can sit down with the earphones in, follow my instructions, and I will take you through a basic 10 minute, we'll say, mindfulness meditation that hopefully will really fucking relax you. And ultimately what I want is, what I'm really excited about is, if you've never meditated, here's your chance now to have a crack at it, and for you to go, fuck me, why didn't I know about this?
and then for you to become a person who meditates. Before I do it, like, meditation is one of these things that it gets thrown around a lot. Meditation and mindfulness are things that get thrown around a lot as easy solutions for people with mental health issues. I'm sure many of you have gone to a doctor with depression or anxiety only to be almost insulted by them saying to you, exercise and meditate, which is it's a bullshit. When someone's in crisis, that's a bullshit solution. Exercise and meditation are essential parts of a good mental health regime that should be included, but they're not really a solution to anything, you know? It's more complex than that. I want to speak about meditation as something that you can engage with and do. It's like I'm suggesting to you a nice meal or a nice restaurant, you know, not to cure anything. Another thing, just to put agency into your hands. Meditation isn't for everybody. 99% of the time, it's an intensely pleasurable, brilliant, harmless thing to do, a natural thing. However, it can, in very rare situations, be unpleasant for some people. Mainly people who may suffer what's known as body trauma, okay? But what I mean by that is, like, with meditation, a lot of it is scanning and checking in with your body, different parts of your body. So if, I don't know, you were attacked at some point, if you're a victim of an assault of some description, and a traumatic emotional experience is tied up with a physical injury at a certain part of your body, some of the emotional trauma and the memories of it can, stored is the wrong word, but they can mentally correlate with that part of your body. So some people, a very small amount of people, when they meditate and scan their bodies, overwhelming negativity can come up that can correlate to a trauma they experienced. If you've been in a car crash, for instance, you know, and it hurts your legs or your arm or whatever, car crashes are no crack. They're terrifying, frightening things that the brain simply goes, that's too much, I'm not dealing with that, after the unconscious mind with you. So meditation in rare situations can bring up emotional, physical trauma around a car crash. If you've ever gotten an unprovoked box into the head or a headbutt, you know, especially if you're a lad, I've received many punches into the face in my life and many headbutts, especially when I was a teenager. And you're a lad, so you have to take it on the chin, as you say, or fucking fight back. But it's still frightening and it's not nice. Even though you can't say it out loud and you can't admit it, no one likes getting a box into the fucking head. Stuff like that can come up. I'm not saying it will, I'm just being responsible. So maybe go off and do a bit of reading and end the podcast now. But for anyone who would like a crack at a fucking guided meditation, let's go for it. Let's do it. All right? This will be a simple 10 minutes. Mindfulness and body scan meditation. A grounding meditation. And we'll go for it. I'm going to turn off the piano. I'm going to turn off the piano and I'm going to go wild. All right? Because I'd like silence for this. You need silence for it. So the piano is turning off now. So now you're just left with my naked voice. So what I'd like you to do if you're starting a meditation is, how you sit is quite important, all right? You can do it lying down if you want. Like if you're in hospital or something, you want to do it while lying down, that's fine. But I would recommend finding a comfortable upright position in a chair. If you're a beginner, the best place to do it is somewhere silent and private in your own home. Or what I like to do is to find a park bench or go somewhere near a river. Somewhere with a bit of nature can be really nice. If you're on a walk, just sit down on a log or something. So now that you're sitting,
how we kind of start is, you know, settle yourself into a comfortable position. Your feet on the ground, most definitely. Your arse on the seat. Your back upright. You don't necessarily have to have a back support, but it helps. And then, in your own time, just close your eyes. Have your eyes closed. And what you begin with is what's known as checking in with different parts of your body, okay? So your eyes are closed. And I want you to notice, just notice like the very top of your head. Bring your attention to the top of your head. Now slowly direct your attention to your shoulders. Just notice that they're there. Notice how they feel. There might be a bit of tension there. You're not trying to fight the tension. You're not trying to get out of it. You're noticing that it exists. Now bring your attention to your back, your spine. Visually, kind of notice and feel. Your mind just scanning down your back, all the way down. Now, feel yourself sitting. Feel the weight of your body connecting with the seat that you're sitting on. Notice if it's, is it shifting left? Is it shifting right? Now scan your thighs all the way up to your knees and your hands. What are they up to? Are they in your lap? Are they clasped together? And just bring all that attention to only your hands. You don't have to move them. You don't have to do anything. You're just noticing how your hands are feeling. Are they relaxed? Are they clenched? What's going on with your hands? And finally, visually scan from your knees right down to your feet. Notice your feet connecting with the ground and how the weight of your body in the chair and how the connectedness with the ground underneath you, how you feel present with the earth and your feet kind of as one. What I'd like you to do now is to notice your breathing. Keep your mouth closed and breathe in through your nose. The way to breathe is you want to breathe in through your nose so that if someone was sitting beside you, they'd hear you breathing. And you want to breathe in such a way that your tummy expands. Not so much your chest. You want to make sure that your belly is expanding as you breathe in and then getting smaller as you breathe out. Now, count your breaths. 1 to 4. Breathe in slowly through the nose. 1. Now breathe out. Breathe back in slowly through the nose. Two. And breathe out. Three. And four. Only focus your attention on the breaths. If it helps, you can imagine your breath as a light of a colour of your choosing that travels in your nose, goes all the way down to your belly, expands it, comes back out, travels out your nose again. Counting 1 to 4 each time. This is the only focus of your attention. Don't be worried if thoughts or feelings are coming up and trying to distract you. Don't fight them. Imagine that you're floating on a river and whatever thoughts are coming past, they're just floating past you and you notice them. You allow them to exist. They're just there. They're passing by. They're being noticed. Try and notice what you're feeling. What emotions are coming up for you? Are you feeling good? Or is there maybe something there that might be annoying you a bit of discomfort? If that's the case, you're not going to fight it. You're going to notice it. You're going to allow it to exist. Floats past. The only thing that matters is your breathing and your breaths. And now in your own time, kind of start to bring your attention back to the room that you're in or whatever your surroundings are. You know, maybe listen out what noises are there. Your eyes are still closed, but you're bringing yourself back into the world. Feeling your feet on the ground, your arse in the chair. And when you feel like it, open your eyes. And then you can start stretching out. Stretch out your fucking body, your legs, whatever you want. How did that feel, you prick? Was that enjoyable? You've just meditated for the first time. Fair fucking play for you, to you. If you enjoyed it, make that a part of your daily life. You know, notice how fucking... The first time I meditated, I felt like I'd washed my brain. That's what it felt like. I felt I'd taken my brain out of my head and fucking washed it. If you did that and you found it difficult, that thoughts were flying into your head, distracted, That's grand. There's no real right or wrong way. Sometimes I meditate and it doesn't work for me. Don't come away thinking, oh, I fucked that up, I did it wrong. It's about, there's no such, the whole point of meditation, there's no such thing as right or wrong. That's why the whole time, the focus is upon, I mean, I use the word notice a lot. You notice things. To notice means to observe, whether it be a sensation in the body, an emotion, a thought, noticing. Not controlling, not changing, not fighting, fucking noticing. Like you're on a river and there's leaves floating past you or tins of coke or whatever the fuck, you're noticing it. There's a tin of coke. You're not going, fuck's sake, what's there a tin of coke doing in the river? What prick threw that in there? You're going, there's a tin of coke. Nothing I can do about it. It's floating past. That's how mindfulness meditation works. When you get really good at that, you can start bringing it into your everyday life. Like I said before, I might fucking wash the dishes in a mindful fashion. I'll be washing the dishes, noticing the suds on my hands or the smell in the air, bringing that concentrated accepting mindfulness to a daily activity as a way to reduce stress and feel fucking class and improve my mental health. I was very, very, very strongly tempted during that to do some of it as the throat of no crack. Very tempted. I want you to relax. And just imagine, like, man, imagine you're in Barcelona, sitting on a beach, drinking Stella Artois. And you feel so fucking relaxed. You're not thinking once about the fucking cunts at home. The cunts at home, I want to see you down, man. Fuck them. You're here to relax, right? You're here to fucking relax. And if you don't do it, man, you're getting glassed. It's all about it. I swear to God, it's all about it. All right, I got that out of my system. I didn't do it in the middle of the fucking meditation. I hope you enjoyed that. I really do. If you want more, I'll do them. There's not much I can fucking expand on that, to be honest. There isn't really. That's a basic mindfulness meditation. Go back to it if you want, if you enjoyed it. Once in the morning, once in the evening, if you like. Don't do them too close to bed. You'd think that that would relax you for sleep, but it actually doesn't. That stimulates the mind. It doesn't prepare you for going to sleep. If you do that at 11 or 12 o'clock, you'll most likely want to stay up. It's a good morning thing. It's a good evening thing. And I don't know, get to the situation where you can do it. You can do that to yourself. You don't need me guiding it. Or whatever. Whatever the fuck works for you. Yurt. I'll talk to you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.